Trina Nadurin, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Maria Barnard, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars, Anthony Manzo, and Carl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Craig-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ailey. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 7:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, more talk radio with our hosts, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guests are Patricia Rumer and Marco Mejia from the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KBOO was born. After 48 years, KBOO Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KBOO is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.
KBOO's membership drive is coming up in September. Help us promote the work of this amazing station by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and now Snapchat, rating our app on the iTunes and Google Play Store, and joining our Facebook event for the upcoming membership drive. Oh, and don't forget to join or renew your membership. Just click donate on our website or app and start your monthly contribution to your community radio, KBOO.
This is More Talk Radio on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, and 104.3 in Corvallis via the World Wide Web. It is kboo.fm. My name is Cecil Prescott, and today is Monday, August 29th, 2006. Today, we are pleased to have with us Marco Mejia and Pat Rumor from Emerge
Interfaith Movement
for Immigrant
Justice. But, you know, I didn't know where the R and the J came from, but that's why I got confused. Emerge is a coalition of organizations and individuals fighting for immigrant justice based here in Oregon. And they are here to talk about their organization and about immigration in general. Just before we came on the air, I was asking them whether or not they had gotten advanced copies of one of the presidential candidate's immigration speech that he is supposed to make sometime this week. But they have not, but they have probably more important things to talk about anyway. So thank you, Pat and Marco, for joining us.
Thanks, Francis.
Thank you for inviting us today.
Oh, great. And thank you for coming so early in the morning. I really appreciate that. Perhaps we can begin by sharing a little bit about Emerge, talk about its origin and its purpose. Marco.
Emerge, the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, and the R comes is just to an arrangement for the word, so it sounds like emerge, emerging. Mm-hmm. The R just comes from immigrant, and using one of those R's. But anyway, so the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, it was born, if we want to call it that way, in 2006-07, when the Sensenbrenner Bill came out, and it was proposed to Congress, and it won, already passed in the House, I think. It was going to what's the other one? The House and the
Senate.
Mm-hmm. There we go. So he passed, and it was one of the bills that historically has been the most enforcement and the most anti-immigrant bill in history. Really bad, which included persecuting anyone, not just immigrants, but persecuting anyone that will be in contact. Not even helping, but in contact, you're doing something or dealing with something and minimum things with any undocumented immigrant. So that kind of raised a lot of the outrage in the community, in all the communities. And you remember all these big marches and mobilizations that were actually bigger in history of this country in 2007. So Emerge, here in Portland, we started organizing. We've been always organized in different forms of coalition building and stuff like that. So we had the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, and from it, the people that represented the sectors of faith came together and said, well, we need to do some response also from the faith perspective, because we're here, a lot of us here, and there has been a lot of history also of faith communities building it. Contributing to, you know, historically, social justice struggles and all of that. So when we were doing that, for many people that didn't even know about the sanctuary movement of the 80s, actually some of us we did, but some others, you know, we live in a country of very short memories and history, historical memory, which is the bad thing. But that was good that we started to say, well, we need to do this. And then other people around the country were thinking about the same thing. So we started to communicate it once that we had some kind of connections nationally in terms of the movement building. And others were doing the same thing and say, hey, why we don't have a national gathering? And we did have one national gathering with, I think, I don't remember at this point, but it was about 30, 35 different sanctuary movements that were being kind of reborn, if you want to call it. And then we call it the New Sanctuary Movement. And new because, not because it's something very new, it's just that it was kind of following the tradition of sanctuary from the 80s and from the history of sanctuary, you know, for faith communities for thousands of years. So that's kind of the rough history. And I will stop there because we'll continue talking about what we do and all of that stuff. But that's how we were born. And then we pretty much, one of the things that that I like to say is that gave a lot of strength and got a lot of people that more involved in the movement was when the raids of the Del Monte factory mm-hmm. happened, that there were about 170 plus, especially women workers that were raided and detained. And they were, you know, moms and grandmas and daughters and sons, and everyone was detained. So that outraged the community here locally in Portland too. And we had the same day that happened, we had a big gathering of faith communities in Portland. It was very big, about 150 people came from a large number of congregations, and we started to continue giving response to see how can we provide sanctuary to the people that are being persecuted in that way.
Thank you. Pat, you've certainly been involved in these issues for many decades, and perhaps Marco mentioned the movement in the 80s right. in terms of immigrant. Tell us more about that. What's different about what's happening these days?
Yes, because I was living in New York City in the 80s and was a member at Riverside Church, which was a part of the sanctuary movement. And we received a family from Guatemala who lived in the church for several years, and we offered actual physical sanctuary. And the impetus really came from people on the border who suddenly saw, you know, and we not only were receiving people who were coming across the border fleeing incredible violence because of the various wars in Central America. And they really looked at the fact that our government was not, in the 80s, was not following its own rules around asylum seekers in terms of political asylum, and decided, looking really to the history in the United States of the Underground Railroad, that they were going to have the equivalent of an Underground Railroad of taking people safely from the border and, you know, sending them to different parts of the United States where they could be safe. They could receive sanctuary in different faith congregations, because it's not just Christian churches, because Jewish synagogues have also been part of that. And I think increasingly a much more interfaith dimension, including Muslims and other faith practitioners. I think the difference is that in the early 80s, politically, Congress was in a slightly different place, President Reagan was the president at that point, and he was pursuing a policy to stop immigrants coming from Central America. Meanwhile, the United States government was supplying arms to the various governments which were causing the problems that led people to flee. So the movement was both to provide physical sanctuary, but it was also to educate the North American people about why people were fleeing. And because of our direct involvement in arming many of these governments, there were members of Congress who were really willing to take this on. And probably the most infamous was the Iran-Contragate scandal in terms of trading drugs with Iran and getting arms and arming the Contras, you know.
Yes.
So, I mean, there was a lot of good, juicy stuff, so to speak, to help people understand what was going on. It's much more complex now. I was in Arizona working as a volunteer at the border this last year for several months, and I talked with Reverend John Fife, one of the originators of the sanctuary movement in Tucson, Arizona in the 80s. And I said, you know, John, how come we're not just there at the border, you know, picking people up in cars and transporting them? And he said, well, because the laws have changed that the penalties right now for us, even in an underground way, transporting people are much more significant. And it's also more difficult because it's, in a sense, less obvious, the U.S. political military involvement in the region. And so the need has not changed, because we still have an influx of people seeking sanctuary. But the political reality is very, very different, mainly because the laws over the last 20 years have become, I didn't realize this myself, but it used to be basically that if you crossed the border from Mexico to the United States, it was the equivalent of a misdemeanor. I mean, you paid a fine, or they just, you know, the Border Patrol just took you and just returned you.
Now, this is just in regard to people who are not U.S. citizens.
That's right.
Crossing into the United
That's
States.
That's right. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you for that clarification.
And the other one is that it was just a recently that it was just a civil offense.
That's right.
Crossing the border.
Yeah. And now it's a criminal.
But it is criminal. And the thing is that we're going to be talking about is how it became criminal.
Right.
Right. It's how the system and the politicians and some interests were criminalizing immigrants. Even the law was not criminalizing immigrants, but already in the culture was changed that mm-hmm. it criminalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that there is still a need for sanctuary, but I think that's a very different political environment because, you know, in the mid-80s, actually there was amnesty. You know, I mean,
it was Reagan.
And it was Reagan, you know. So even though the United States government never gave temporary protected status to Guatemalans, for example. They did to Salvadorians, but not to Guatemalans. And there were so many kind of political fronts that we were working on at that time. And the people who came in sanctuary in different, you know, there were over 1,000 congregations in the height of the sanctuary movement who, if they did not have someone living in a physical sanctuary, were part of a support network. But more importantly, they were really part of an education advocacy network to try to convince members of Congress as well as the general public. And I think equally important is that the refugees, because that's what I believe they were, who spoke, were able to break through the media lock that Reagan and the government had on saying, you know, that we were defending the good guys in Central America, and the refugees were able to say, this is really what's happening.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, your community radio station. I'm Cecil Prescott, my co-host.
I am Celeste Carey, and you are listening to your community connection, KBOO, at 90.7 in the metro area, 91.9 in points east, and in points south, it is 104.3. Everywhere, it's KBOO.FM.
We're speaking this morning with Marco Mejia and Pat Rumor of Emerge, Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to ask is, we have at time either highlighted people from either the Far East Asian countries and the Central American countries, or we have I'm trying to say a negative way of, we'll say spotlighted, you know, people who have come. And by highlight versus spotlight, I mean there's those that we have allowed or mm-hmm. encouraged and those that we didn't, sometimes from the very same region. And in this particular case, can you speak to why there were certain countries we let people in and why the others were kept out? Because that was another one of the political mm-hmm. issues that got people confused about why 1 minute there was influx, and the next minute the Border Patrol was throwing their hands up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually was the City of Portland's first refugee coordinator in the early 1980s. And that's an excellent example of we received in the state of Oregon almost 25,000 Southeast Asians between 75 and 1980. And many other states took in many more people. And that was a political decision. I mean, they were people who were our allies on the ground. It was a military war that we fought. And when we lost, or when it ended, they were stranded, and so we followed through and said, "Okay, they can come." And it was an enormous effort. I think that Americans have forgotten. North Americans. I just heard
that
this
morning. We've forgotten about the boat people.
Pardon?
We've forgotten about the boat.
That's right.
People with the quotations. Yes.
That's right. I heard this morning on that we have almost, by the end of this month, meaning 2 days from now or 3 days from now, we will have successfully brought in 10,000 Syrian refugees. We brought in over, I believe, 200,000 Southeast Asians in a five-year period of time. So we have the capacity to absorb a large number of people. And we have the mechanisms, we have refugee systems, and we have nonprofit agencies that handle refugee resettlement, et cetera. And it's always to our, you know, where is our political and military interests? What I say to people is there's only one country in the world that if you get into the United States, if you step over the line or you land on an island in Florida, if you are from Cuba, you are in. It's the only country in the world that if you can physically become present in the United States, you will be accepted. And that's one of the, I think, injustices or unfairness of our system is the way that, in a sense, we're very selective. I don't know, Marco, you have a...
Yeah, I like to always put things in perspective also, and why this government and this country does that. I think that, as Pat is saying, you know, those are political decisions that respond to a lot of different interests, mm-hmm. economical interests, military interests, power domination interests, and bullying. You know, being the stronger and the powerful that it's managing the whole world. So if we see in history, the United States has been using people and communities and countries. Starting with how we were born in this country, born meaning that there was something before, mm-hmm. right? It was people, communities, civilizations, etc., living here in this land, and in order to the Europeans to come and have their own land, they saw that they need labor, mm-hmm. and free labor, not just cheap labor, but free labor, and they engaged in the slave trade. Mm-hmm. So that's how it started, in this period at least, right? Here, speaking about this country. And that's the way that how slavery and the using of other people's lives and you know, work has been one of the main pillars of development of this country. Mm-hmm. So if they have been going and they continue going, intervening all over the world, going to countries, remember that why they went into Vietnam, why they went to other countries, that at the end, because it was so open that they were actually engaging in the war, that they had to open the doors and say, okay, we're going to get some refugees, and they opened the door for those people at that time. Other times, they deny other people because yes. those people in those countries, in those areas, are not of the interest of the United States. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one of the things that, and I am saying that is because, you know, we're talking about the sanctuary and providing sanctuary. And that is pretty much breaking the law. Right? Mm-hmm. Openly. But we, the faith communities, not just Christians, just to be clear, it's an interfaith movement. So we have people from different faiths. We believe that, you know, as the times of, like, I'm coming from the Christian tradition, you know, Jesus Christ was accused of terrorist, somebody that doesn't want to obey the law of those times, right? And what he did is for one reason. And that's what we're doing it today, is because those laws were unjust. Those were not to benefit the well-being of the people and the human beings. So the our role that we have as faith communities is to actually do that, the same exact thing. When there's unjust laws, we need to fight against those to come, you know, to sense and to justice. And so that's why we have had, you know, people from different countries. That's why the United States decides that they want to have some people from this area or not, etc. Remember that also, and I just started speaking about slavery, but then later, you know, slavery kind of went modernizing its way. Right now we are calling slavery easily it's undocumented immigrants, right? Because
everything
like that. Yeah. So we are the product, and I'm saying we because I'm an immigrant too, and many of us are here also, or our ancestors. It's that we are coming and moving because there's a lot of injustice happening, and the intervention, actually the migration that is happening, is not created by us. is created by this system here, the very system of the corporations, the economy, and the global economy that is creating, exploiting people, destroying countries, going and mining everywhere and getting people out of their lands, etc. That how people have to go somewhere to live and find a life where their kids can and their families can grow in peace. So that's what's happening. And people don't know or ignore or others don't want to know that, that that's what the reality is, that that this country, the policies, the foreign policy and the corporations and the economy is the one that's creating all of this. And we are the blamed ones because we live in a country that also you blame the victim. Right? The corporations are the poor people, right? Yeah. We, the consumers and the workers, are the bad ones, the ones that we want some justice for us. Mm-hmm.
So I want you to expand a little bit more on this conversation in terms of your philosophy around this. Certainly you are an interfaith movement. I think that's important to emphasize because so much of the political rhetoric we hear today on the national and on the state level is very anti-immigrant. And often coming from people of religious conviction. I was listening to an interview on yesterday morning with the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party, and he was talking about very anti-immigrant statements. But also he proclaims, and you know, he's a man of faith. And I thought it was curious because one of the readings in the Christian tradition yesterday was about showing hospitality. Mm-hmm. As part of your work as Emerge, do you reach out to other religious groups who have a different perspective? What type of education work do you do to inform communities that this is something that is demands our attention?
Well, I think education is a strong part or component of what we try to do and make available. Recently, one of our volunteers has just concluded a 2-month kind of reflection series with a Latino church about the meaning of sanctuary. One of the things is that sanctuary is not a common understanding in all traditions. And so what in terms of reflecting on the Bible, and this was with a diverse group of people, I don't know where they stand politically or not, but they just wrestling with the whole issue of sanctuary. And because as you know, that even within various immigrant communities, there is not 100% agreement. There are some people who feel, well, I've made it, I'm here, and they say nobody else should come. So part of that is working within different settings to try to understand why hospitality is being offered. And I think also we have reached out to not just people from Central America. We do a lot of letter writing and accompanying people to court hearings who come from different parts of the world. I believe there was someone either from Ethiopia or another country that recently we've been working to try to... trying to make
Korea,
sure. So it's not just around a particular region. It's around, as Marco said, an unjust system which captures a lot of different people. In the transition shelter where I volunteered in Tucson, we had people from Nepal. We had people from different parts of Asia and Africa. The majority are from Central America just because of our physical proximity. But when we look at 1 out of 7 people in the world is a refugee at this point, the majority of them are coming from Africa or the Middle East and are landing in Europe, not in the United States. So I don't think, Cecil, that we've really taken on trying to reach out to a lot of different, perhaps, church traditions that might have a different political perspective. But we are certainly open to invitation to do an educational series on our understanding of hospitality and the need for sanctuary.
And also, I'd like to say that we build those relationships. Not everyone needs to be part of this coalition, this movement, or the movement, yes, but this organization that's organizing. And we do have those relationships and build those relationships, because I think that one important thing that I like to say is that most of the traditions that we know, especially the historic, faith traditions, have hospitality as one of the main, beliefs, principles.
Love and care of the stranger. Love,
exactly. So it's not just for Christians, it's for everyone else. So we have a lot of things in common, and if we cannot be, we don't need to be part of the same group, et cetera, but we build those relationships on the local and the national level. So we are part of that network, if we want to call it.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Join the conversation with Pat Roemer and Marco Mejia at 503-231-8187. And we have two folks waiting online. Good morning, Sunny.
Good morning. Good morning. This is an important conversation. Thank you both for your efforts to provide some kind of shelter and safety and support for those persons who are trying to find those things. And I wonder if this movement will extend into the increasing problems that we're having in America. I wonder if Amy Goodman covered it this morning on her show, the terrible stuff that has happened in Muskogee, Oklahoma, with the African-American family there. I didn't get to hear Amy Goodman this morning. Did you hear her? Did she mention anything about Muskogee?
No, I'm not aware.
See the footage pertaining to the 80-year-old woman and her son, he was fleeing because he'd run a stoplight, and how he fled into his home, and then what followed into the home, a whole battalion of police officers kicking down the door and the tasing inside their own home. Clearly, many Americans need sanctuary, and this behavior sometimes comes from the police, sometimes comes from gang enclosure. Targeting of individuals also occurs across colors and class. I wonder if there could be a co-joining of this effort, because I tell you, if I lived in Muskogee right now, or sometimes the way I feel living out here in a lovely neighborhood of Southwest Portland, where we've ended up with nooses on our fence twice, the idea of sanctuary and welcoming and beginning to comprehend what is occurring to many Americans, neighborhood to neighborhood, block to block, it's probably going to reach that point, or it seems like it is. We need to have sanctuary for our people also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Thanks very much for mentioning all of this, because I think that what we are focusing today is because this is a very specific thing that we as faith communities are working on. But also, it doesn't mean that sanctuary is only for people that are going through the hardship and the persecution and the oppression, if you want to call it, as immigrants are doing right now. The one of the big communities that has been going through all of that is immigrants. As you probably know, every year there is about more than 400,000 migrants that are being deported from the United States. 400,000. So if you can count that, how many families that means, etc. And that means that, other hundreds of thousands of people and families have been going through the detention centers, the detention system, and going to jails that, by the way, are private businesses that are very rich and very happy that there's this policy happening. That is happening. So it's a big, huge, a crisis that we are going through. Of course, there's a lot of other things that are happening, in our country, in our communities. And we do understand that, and the analysis that we have is not to leave that. Actually, those are one of the reasons, in this case for migrants, like the things that happen in this country, that inside this country, are the root causes of migration for other people, like communities of color, like the black communities, how they have been persecuted and killed, you know, in big numbers, and detained and jailed, etc. It's a big crisis too. So I think that we need to reach out more. I will say not just we as faith communities, but in general, all of us that believe, you know, in justice, that we need to build a sanctuary and become, you know, and try to get this country. Our homes should be a sanctuary. That is how it should be. Our communities should be a sanctuary, our neighborhoods, to defend ourselves from things that are not good for our neighborhoods or our people. And what I'm talking about is that, you know, if we have, you know, a fair society where everyone is treated fairly, you know, it won't be that there won't be a need, because that means that there's sanctuary happening when we have justice and fairness in our communities. So yes, we should be working and spreading more the word, and not just the word, but building these sanctuaries everywhere. I have one example that, you know, happened UMC, the
United Methodist Church.
Sorry, sometimes, you know, the UMC, the UCCs, the this and that. And I forgot that. But anyway, so the Methodists, you know, in the Philippines, there was this big crisis. And it's just an example, because there's a lot of things happening everywhere in the world, right? Is that, you know, there was the peasants were protesting because, you know, they had this big drought and the government was not really doing anything to help them, this community. So they came to a town, and what they were, what they met was actually bullets and the military shooting at them. And so in that, what was happening, close by there was a church, United Methodist Church, and they opened the doors for them as a sanctuary to come in and run away from the bullets, you know, and the soldiers when they were. So you see, this is not in the end of migrants. They were people, you know, peasants. And so it's an example in how we need to actually, you know, spread this idea of sanctuary, what it means for our communities and everyone else. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's not just that. We need to also look at some of our contradictory laws, concepts, practices, and policies, because what good is sanctuary if you cannot count on your home, depend on your home to be sacrosanct? Mm-hmm. So this man runs into his home for being afraid and basically committing a minor crime. Running a signal. But in some communities, you have what's called stand your ground. You get to defend your home. Mm-hmm. So we have a contradictory idea of who is allowed a home and a sacrosanct, impenetrable sanctuary. And for some people, and specifically I'm going to reference George Zimmerman, it mm-hmm. wasn't even his home. Mm-hmm. It was the generalized location of a neighborhood. So we need to recognize that not only do we deny people a place to be safe when they're running from danger that very often this community, or rather this country, has caused, but within this country, we don't allow some people to even have a home of their own that they already own and have that be safe. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Good morning, Francis.
Hi. Thank you for your discussion today, and thank you for the work you guys do. I had a lot of questions, but the distinction now that's being made between calling people refugees as opposed to immigrants, or preferring to call people immigrants rather than refugees. I don't know if it's because the refugee has a connotation of maybe they're actually fleeing from something. And years ago it was brought to my attention that people fleeing or trying to get here from Haiti were treated totally different than people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As you said, or coming from Cuba or mm-hmm. somewhere else. If you could talk about that a little bit, that was pretty alarming to me when I realized that. And if you have time, I'm really concerned about these young people, minor children who came from Honduras after the military coup that our government didn't want to call a military coup. If you could talk about that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Great questions.
All right, you take care.
All right. We have an immigration system, and there's rules and regulations, and, you know, there's quotas and all that. So that's, in a sense, a legal terminology that when you apply to come to the United States as an immigrant, the refugee is another political recognition that there is international human rights law. Our country has laws which guarantees protection of people who are asylum seekers. In other words, they're fleeing because of violence or because of domestic abuse or human trafficking or a variety of categories which we recognize legally give them legal grounds to apply for asylum and to be received as refugees. We are breaking, at the same time, the Border Patrol and the immigration court system are breaking our own rules by denying people. For example, you don't have the right to legal representation. The people who are held in these detention centers, they're very fortunate if they get access to an attorney, but mostly in another language, they're trying to defend themselves and to explain why they fled their country. The Haiti was a tragic situation because many of the Haitians were fleeing. From the U.S. government's perspective, they were fleeing. They were economic immigrants or economic refugees. They were not political refugees. And that's why, according to our government, they were turned away and sent back to Haiti.
But that's an arbitrary definition,
too. Oh, yes.
You know, we need to remember that.
That's right. And and that's part of what, again, goes back to what Marco and what you, Celeste, said in terms of some of the economic reasons. Right now, we are denying people from Honduras that they are fleeing incredible violence. And it does go back to the 2009 coup, and that the destabilization of many of these countries that we are responsible for, how can I put it? We're not 100% responsible because there are local elites in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, as well as drug gangs, et cetera, that are also contributing factors. But our foreign policy has not been helpful in terms of stabilizing these countries. We are breaking the law also in the sense that we are keeping children and minors and their families in detention. And there is a court in California that has struck down and ordered the U.S. government to change its practices. And it still has not done that. So it's such a complicated situation. But that's why we feel so strongly in the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice that we're focused on justice and paying attention to obeying the laws that actually exist.
I was wondering, as we talk about that, you know, and the terrible situation people face in their countries of origins, and also when they if they arrive into the United States, part of the work that I heard that you do is bring awareness to these horrible situations. And I think both you, Pat, and Marco mentioned in terms of family separation and detention centers. For those of us who are unaware of the horrors, could you paint a picture of some of the challenges and desperate situation that many families face?
And we have some right here in the United States, right there in Texas on the border.
But I'm talking about here in
Portland. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, there are many families. We do take the 2007 Del Monte raid. Many of those women ended up facing deportation. And if their children were born in the United States, then their children could remain while the mother was deported. That's one example. We see just the stories. there's a place on in Nogales, Mexico, run by the Jesuits called the Kino Border Initiative. And it's a feeding center. It's for people basically who are waiting to cross into the United States or people who've just been deported. And that's one of the places where I volunteered. And you provide basic medical assistance. You provide some human rights advice and cell phone service. People could call their families. And I met so many people who had lived in the United States for 20 or 25 years, were stopped on a traffic violation or something like that, discovered they didn't have papers, were deported, were desperately trying to get back to their families. Some families who, half the family lives in Phoenix or Tucson and half the family, you know, lives in Mexico, and they're trying to figure out how to reunite that family. It is heartbreaking. There's been many, many articles written about it. Maybe Marco, I don't know if you think of any other examples. I visited people in detention centers, and let me tell you, they are privately run prisons, and this is one of the areas where there's tremendous coalition building between Black Lives Matter and a number of other groups. It has to do with the fact that recently the Department of Justice has just said that it will suspend private prisons for regular, quote, people going to prison. And what we're now looking at is how do we get them to end the immigration bed quota, that every night there have to be 34,000 people in immigration detention centers run by these private corporations. Talk about a guaranteed income. 34,000 beds have to be filled every day. And so that's one of the places where we're trying to work across a variety of groups to say that we need to end the private prison operation because they are not great places at all. I'll stop there.
Yeah, I think that there's so many. We were talking about numbers, and the numbers could be a little kind of abstract, right? We're talking about, I mentioned that 400,000 or more than that people have been deported every year.
And is it correct that under Obama, more people have
that's been? Yes, in the Obama administration, true. Yes, it has been more than before. So those numbers, how they translate into the reality and what you're saying, you know, in terms of human reality, the human aspect of it. So in Portland, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people that live in those conditions you know, it's that every day we know, or in the family, we don't know what's going to happen at the end of the day and how things are going to be. Everyone goes to work because everyone has to work. Well, in this American nightmare, because it's not an American dream anymore, a lot of people have to work in each home to provide, you know, the basic needs. So the same thing for migrants, and it's even more difficult because it's a very low wage and it's more unexploited and more vulnerable working, you know, workers. So they have to work 10, 12, 14 hours a day, many of them. And at the end, not just that, but they don't know if you're going to come back. If your dad, your mom, your grandma, your brother, your sister are going to come back. Because if there's a raid, if there's something that's happening, if somebody's going to be pulled out for the broken lights in their car and get exposed to the police, can end up, you know, in jail and can end up deported. So that's one of those things that, you know, it's like, and then the families will be torn apart. And the experience to going through that is what people really need to think about and try to see if they can internalize that. Is that if you live in fear every day, like when you're persecuted, because many people come and we come from countries that we have been persecuted by the police, by everyone that looking after our family members, etc. And that you live that every day, that you don't know if that person is going to be beat, you know, is going to be detained and disappeared, or in this case, you know, disappeared in a way that is what happened. You know, many people don't even know that they just don't get home, don't know what happened. Did they die? or they were deported. So that is a very difficult situation for our families. And in many cases, many of the people that are providing the, you know, for the food and for the rent, those are the ones that have been deported. So those families end up in the streets. Because those kids, you know, they don't have any more the source of, you know, the for eating, for having, you know, the basic needs resolved. So those things, I will say, you know, in one hand, you know, the economic thing is very harsh and difficult, but especially is this thing about, you know, living with this big pressure and fear that we don't know what's going to happen to our families at the end of the day. That is a very difficult thing. And many people, if you don't experience that, you don't know what that means for us. Many families, many poor families especially, from all backgrounds, they know, they experience that, you know, in different, many different ways. But the ones that don't, they cannot understand what's happening.
And certainly, you know, every person is important, but we have a caller who's called, you know, oftentimes talking about immigrants taking our jobs.
Yes.
But also that, as you mentioned, living in that fear, not knowing if the people who are providing for you, those who are left, are many of them are American citizens.
Yes. Oh, many of them. It has been historically, I think that we were talking a little bit ago, and we are not still mentioning the word, the big word, which is racism and white supremacism. So all of these that we're talking about is crushed by it. Why we immigrants of color are being persecuted? It's not white immigrants that are being persecuted. They're not. Why historically, we need to ask ourselves, why historically, you know, the migrants that are white that came from Europe that at some point were, you know, were not wanted, like, you know, the Italians or others, at the end, they ended up blending into the whiteness of the United States.
Right, being assimilated.
Assimilated because the color, their color. Others cannot be assimilated, even though if you get to be a rich person, you are a person of color and you're a migrant, and you will be, you know, seen as that. So I think that that's one of the big elements that we need to think about, and that's why we are like that. But the one that you're talking about, you know, stealing jobs and stuff like that, I think that that's one of the myths that the system and the people that want to keep these very vulnerable workers in that way use it, because it is not true that immigrants are stealing jobs. Actually, there was, you know, the I remember this show, the Stephen Report.
Remember? Colbert.
Mm-hmm. Colbert Report. Mm-hmm. He did it, you know, with the farm workers and invited the United Farm Workers and say, well, you're stealing our jobs. And they said, no, we're not stealing any jobs.
And you're taking our benefits.
Exactly.
When you're resettled, you get a car and a house and a five-figure salary.
Everything.
Yes.
So what he said is, so show me, why is that? He said, no, look, the UFW has been opening jobs in the internet. And there's about seven people that are U.S. citizens that apply for those jobs. Nobody else is applying. And I'm not saying that the ones that work, that it's not wanted by others, that kind of thing. It's how the system has been created, that they have put certain jobs for certain people, right? And but anyway, so nobody went, and actually he went to work.
Right.
Because he said, well, it's open. And he said, will you work then if it's open? And he went one day. And at the end of the day, he was almost dead. Mm-hmm. And he said that, of course, who wants to work in these conditions, right? Yes. So that's the point, is that many people, of course, you don't want to go and work in situations and conditions that your body and your health is going to be, you know, at risk. And at risk for the rest of your life. There's jobs that, you know, if you work 2-3 years on those, you're going to be, you know, in problem.
You're going to be old before your time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that I think a lot of our American Black listeners should think about, and by American Black, I mean those who have been here, historically descended from African slaves here, is the work that a lot of immigrants do is very similar to what American Black slaves did in the fields. So it is that kind of rigorous, hard, backbreaking, killing work. And we struggled not to have to do that kind of work, but remember that we have other people that are being, that are replacing us because we're not the quote-unquote free labor anymore, and this system demands free or cheap labor. Mm-hmm. We do have a couple of callers. I'd like to see if we can squeeze them in, and I also want to give a website here, too, for people of faith who want to know more about this whole issue of learning how refugees work together. It is called the IAFR.org, and it's International Refugee, International Refugee, I lost it just that fast. I'll come back, but let us go to George real quick.
Hi, I just wanted to know if the subject of the United States providing computer-generated and, I'd say, human intelligence-generated lists of names of radicals to governments in Central America, Mexico, Haiti, Indonesia, and others, followed by extensive murders by often by off-duty military or on-duty military in, for example, Guatemala, El Salvador, Indonesia, and is this something that you or your guests are familiar with?
Very quick, because we don't have much time. Yes, of course. That has been one of the tactics that has been used for many, many, many years in terms of going after the people that they don't want. So, yes, they do that. And they do it actually here inside in the United States, just to let you know. If you remember the history, how that has happened, the FBI, how they've been, persecuting and going after the people during the civil rights movement, during the Vietnam War, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a practice that has happened and continues happening.
Okay, thank you, George.
Thank you, George.
We have to move on. And before we go to our next caller.
Be sure to mention your benefit coming up.
Oh, thank you. September 21, I think.
they're looking it up.
I should have it here on another page,
But in
too.
The meantime, and we'll give you all that information. Let's go to our caller. And Michael, why do you wait till the last minute?
I didn't even know that you guys had this guest on. I just turned in, so I hate that I didn't.
Oh, brother, you need to go to our website first thing Monday morning so you can get in early, because one of the reasons we're doing this is to kind of dispel some of the myths that you have mentioned. But go ahead briefly. Go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I want to say that the Mexicans that's in America, they practice racism. If you go to McDonald's or any place that Mexicans work, the only people that is back there are Mexicans, and so they don't practice diversity. But my next question—
Wait a minute. Are you assuming that a Mexican owns the McDonald's?
No, I'm assuming that Mexicans are back there managing and hiring other Mexicans. So.
Okay, that would then preclude the need for a Mexican to own it, Mike. Come on. You are an intelligent man. Why are you coming over this mess? Let Marco answer that for you.
Yeah, I think that we need to be very careful in terms of, picking on fighting against each other in our communities. And I think that's one of the things that it's happening, and the politicians use it. We don't have anything to do with hiring, especially in the corporations, right? So what they prefer, and actually going back to what we were saying, racism in this country just have led to say, no, we don't want to have black workers in my factory. I don't want to rent, as as Trump did, I don't want black people to rent my apartments. And that's what I do. And they hire whoever is there. And we are just being the subjects of that. So migrants are part of that, the victims of the system that is exploiting workers and it's, getting us each other against each other. So at the end, we don't get together and stronger and say, no, we're not going to accept this injustice.
But here's my real question. Here's my real question.
Okay, you have about 30 seconds.
Here's my real question. Why don't Mexicans stay in Mexico and fight to make that better? In America, when things aren't right, Americans, they had a revolution. They go out in the street. They boycott.
We got the point.
Let them respond.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So in the United States, I will call it, things are not right to start, as you were saying. It's actually one of the countries where there's more exploitation as in any other country. And as we mentioned before, Mexicans or Brazilians or people from Europe, from Asia, etc., come here because there's big reasons. Things are not changing there. People there are fighting for it. Mm-hmm. They're giving their lives. And many of them, because that has been even the last resort that a lot of people I know, you know, that's what's happening. So they need to flee. That's what is happening.
Yes, okay, thank you, Michael. And so
let's get this benefit out. And let me give the website really quick. Go ahead.
I was about to say it, but
The same thing. Well, the website that I mentioned was International Association for Refugees, IAFR.org. And for people of faith, especially Christians who don't believe they should have refugees, you need to check out that.
Check out Emerge website.
Also.
Emerge, IMIRJ. And your benefit is September 21. Mm-hmm. At the First United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm. And we're at 6 p.m.
Yeah, yes. And we're celebrating 10 years. We're really remembering what we've accomplished and what we still have to do in the next 10 years.
Yeah, you can go to the Facebook, the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, and you can get tickets and the rest of the information there.
So. Rest of the information. Perfect. Thank you so much for the work. Thank you for all of our members and supporters for keeping KBOO free to bring information to people. People who need to be resettled, people who have open arms and welcoming borders. That's what we do here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
Tony Ozier and the Doodoo Funk All-Stars are teaming up with KBOO Community Radio and Audio Globe for another installment of the Dookie Jam. That's September 1st at 10 p.m. at Dante's at 350 West Burnside in downtown Portland. Audio Globe is an audiovisual recording company that specializes in high-fidelity capture and streaming services, providing global reach to regional and national artists on audioglobe.com. The Dookie Jam brings together some of the region's best funk, soul, rock, R&B, and jazz musicians to jam one night a month live at Dante's. The Dookie Jam is happening September 1st, 10 p.m., and we'll be streaming live on KBOO.FM and AudioGlobe.com.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume